Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is Side 2 of For the Record program number 658, titled Update on the Meltdown. This has been recorded on December 28th of the year 2008. Please, SpitfireList.com, the best source for anti-fascist information on Earth. We're going to plunge right in where we left off in Side 1. Again, this program is updating people on the financial meltdown and the economic meltdown. Reminds me of the introduction to Kurt Vonnegut's novel, The Sirens of Titan, in which Vonnegut wrote many, many years ago, by the way, almost half a century ago. Our story begins a long, long time ago, during the Nightmare Age, sometime between the Second World War and the Third Great Depression. Yes, indeed. Bernard Madoff, as we indicated in Side 1, has claimed himself to be the lone nut behind this. Many people are highly skeptical of this. Among the immediate elements of fallout was the fact that the Attorney General of the United States recused himself from the investigation of Lee Harvey Madoff because his son, that is to say Mark Mukasey, is representing one of Madoff's top associates in this particular operation, one Frank Piscotti. Frank DePiscali from New Jersey. And we're going to be investigating and ruminating about Lee Harvey Madoff and the largest Ponzi scheme in history for most of this side of the broadcast. Now, we concluded Side 1 of the program with an article from the San Francisco Chronicle of Wednesday, December 24th of 2008. The Madoff mystery, where did the money go? Well, indeed, we're going to be talking about where the money might have gone, among other things. And obviously, with my perhaps overly heavy-handed sarcasm in calling Madoff Lee Harvey Madoff, this guy did not do this alone, folks. And we're going to be taking a look at some of the individuals and institutions that figure in this investigation. Skipping down in this Rachel Beck AP Press story. There is also speculation that the money could show up in other spots, maybe in offshore bank accounts, in family members' names, or elsewhere. Well, first of all, as far as offshore bank accounts, in one of the many points of reference that listeners should use here, and again, SpitfireList.com, are the broadcasts and the descriptions for the broadcasts with the remarkable Lucy Commissar, who's been doing a great deal of work about offshore. And maybe people thought that that was a bit of a reach and that it didn't have a whole lot of relevance. Well, just examine what Lucy was talking about on this program in October of 2008 in For the Record 531, talking about AIG and all of its use of offshore. Well, now we've had to bail out AIG and a whole lot of other people that aren't telling us where the money went. And among the places where the money may have gone, and we're going to talk a lot more about these destinations, and again, offshore may very well be where the money is being laundered, so to speak. Laundering the money offshore appears to be one of the things that was going on with Lee Harvey Madoff's operations. New York Times of December 24th of 2008 highlighted one of the considerations. This is an article by Nelson D. Schwartz. It's headlined, Madoff Dealings Tarnish a Private Swiss Bank. It reads in part, for generations, the calling card of Swiss private bankers has been the promise of prudence and discretion. Now, as the links between Bernard L. Madoff and elite private banks like Geneva-based Union Bancaire Privée emerge, this well-polished reputation has been tarnished by the $50 billion Ponzi scheme that Mr. Madoff has been arrested for and accused of running. L'affaire Madoff, as it has become known here and in Geneva, here being Paris, by the way, has cast an unwanted spotlight on the normally shadowy world of private bankers in Switzerland and other cozy hiding places of offshore wealth like the Cayman Islands and Luxembourg. And while there are many Swiss victims in terms of total exposure, UBP is the best-known private bank to get hit with $700 million of its clients' monies invested with Mr. Madoff. Founded in 1969 by Edgar Di Picciotto, UBP quickly became a giant in the conservative world of Swiss banking, where partnerships like Pictet and Lombard-Odier stretch back more than 200 years. With assets of $125 billion and a client base of wealthy individuals, families, and institutions that reach from Qatar to Uruguay to Russia and throughout Europe, it is one of Switzerland's biggest pipelines for channeling client money into hedge funds worldwide and, Dave would add, offshore. About 6 years ago, that business, known as a fund of funds, began to rake in larger fees when it decided to set up a vehicle called M Invest Limited to funnel cash to Mr. Madoff's firm. Through this relationship, UBP claimed it was able to gain close insight into Mr. Madoff's investment operations through copies of trade tickets and an unusual degree of access granted by Mr. Madoff himself to UBP's representatives, according to a confidential internal letter sent to investors on December 17th and obtained by the New York Times. The memorandum, while seeking to reassure investors, could raise questions about why UBP, unlike others who claim to have seen red flags, did not use its access to delve more deeply into the unusually consistent annual returns that Mr. Madoff's funds were reporting. Well, later on we're going to see maybe why UBP didn't feel too inclined to look too deeply, but let's see where this M-Invest Limited was incorporated. Where did it operate out of? Skipping down, the UBP letter acknowledges some concerns over how Mr. Madoff's firm combined investment management and brokerage services, but the Geneva Bank said it found comfort, unquote, in the fact that the firm was subject to routine, unquote, audits by the Securities and Exchange Commission and FINRA, another securities regulator, as well as, quote, Madoff's long-standing reputation in building Wall Street's markets infrastructure, unquote. M-Invest was regulated by the Cayman Islands Monetary Authority, where it was incorporated. Well, Cayman Islands, folks, is offshore, offshore, offshore. Talking about something being regulated through the Cayman Islands is the ultimate oxymoron. The whole point of the Cayman Islands, Luxembourg and Liechtenstein, the Channel Islands, the Bahamas, Bermuda, the whole rationale is to keep those funds opaque and their use opaque so that people can't find out where the money's going. And so that is really interesting indeed. As we get into this, we're going to see, and again, those broadcasts, the many broadcasts with the remarkable and heroic Lucy Commissar about offshore are only too relevant here. Now let's jump back briefly to the San Francisco Chronicle article from Wednesday, December 24th of 2008, The Madoff Mystery, Where Did the Money Go? Well, we're going to take a look at maybe where some of the money that was being handled by Lee Harvey Madoff went. And one of the theories is that, quote, it went into investors' pockets. Well, huh. How about that? It went into investors' pockets. Well, we're going to take a look at who some of those investors, into whose pockets it may have gone. Some of the mystery, where did the money go? Went into investors' pockets. Well, obviously, it went into some investors' pockets, and other people got reamed big time in this thing. Went into investors' pockets. While many of the investors lost everything, some of them received payouts from Madoff over the years. Given that this was a Ponzi scheme, Madoff had to keep up his credibility by allowing people to tap their cash when they wanted. Consider a couple with a $20 million investment with Madoff. They might have pulled out 10% or $2 million a year to use as income, basically living off the returns on their initial investment. So some of the money may have been paid out to knowledgeable inside investors. We're going to take a look at some. A lot of people were investing in this. A lot of people got burned. There has not been a lot of discussion of this one investor, this from the Investors Hub website. Among the investors who were involved here, and I would suggest the possibility that maybe this particular investor knew that things were not as they should have been and got a lot of money out. Guess who one of the investors was? The Thiessen family, folks. The old funders of the Third Reich, the partners of the Bush family in funding Hitler going back to the early 1920s. The Thiessen family, one of the principal elements of the Bormann Capital Network, as I talk about in For the Record 273. Yes, folks, the Thiessens were an investor here. I wonder if a bunch of the money went to the Thiessens. Of course, I'm just a conspiracy theorist, and I'm sure that the Thiessens would not have used Lee Harvey Madoff to do anything untoward. I mean, when have the Thiessens ever done anything untoward? I don't know. Anyway, from Investors Hub, among the investors, Thiessen family, source sends the following. Thiebaud, T-H-Y-B-O, investments grew out of a family office for Thiessen. They have been in fund of funds, it seems, since 1989. Thiebaud International is a proper fund of fund, but its newer class G invests only in one manager, and I'm 99% sure it's Madoff as the returns are almost the same. Some more info. The fund started in January of 2007. Ernst & Young, Luxembourg, are the auditors. Luxembourg, by the way, one of the major offshore elements. UBS Luxembourg is the administrator. And by the way, in the book Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, it talks about the pivotal role of Luxembourg and also Liechtenstein, but Luxembourg in particular in helping to launder money for the Bormann Group. Thiebaud states on their webpage, quote, our track record incorporates audited financial statements at both a composite firm-wide and individual portfolios level, unquote. Well, that's very reassuring. So among the investors in the Madoff, the funds of Lee Harvey Madoff, the Thiessen family, using Luxembourg proprietaries, I wonder, obviously this is what I call food for thought and grounds for further research, I wonder how much of the money went to the Thiessens who were invested in this. The Thiessens, in addition to old running mates of the Bush family and helping to fund fascism going back to the early 20s, the Thiessens, major financiers of the Third Reich, major component of the Bormann Group, and very close to the Bormann family and Martin Bormann in particular since the early 1920s. Again, go to the website, read the book Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, or at the very least, use the description for For the Record 305 with search engines. That'll flesh that out for you. Now, one of the people who apparently was very upset at the shenanigans of Lee Harvey Madoff, perhaps this was just a suicide. I'm extremely skeptical, although it may be that the individual was told, look, you do it or we'll do it. But there have been a number of stories about this particular one from Comcast.net. New York investor who invested in Madoff is found dead. An alleged suicide, I've got my doubts, but we'll see. What is really significant here is not only the fact that this individual deep-sixed himself, or was deep-sixed, remains to be seen, but who this individual was. This particular individual was a member of the long-standing French power elite, and the French financial elite in particular, as discussed at length and in detail in the book Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, and as we talked, as excerpted in the description for the Record 305, the German economic occupation of France, as well as much of the rest of Europe, never ended. And the French power elite and the French economic elite are inextricably linked with the Bormann capital network, as is the Thiessen family. And we'll take a note of that also, as discussed in the book Triumph of Treason, part of which is available for download for free, and in which there are many references, again, on the website spitfirelist.com. The French power elite conspired with their German cartel partners in the run-up to World War II. There were some abortive fascist coups in France prior to the German invasion in 1940, rather like the coup attempt that we had in 1934. They didn't succeed, and so the French power elite deliberately subverted the French defense in World War II to see to it that the Nazis won, because it was only with a military victory by the armies of their cartel partners that democracy could be dispensed with in France and a fascist government imposed, which is what they wanted. Again, the following from Comcast.net, Wednesday, December 24th. New York investor who invested in Madoff is found dead. It reads in part, he was a distinguished investor who traced his lineage to the French aristocracy, hobnobbed with members of European high society, and sailed around the world on fancy yachts. But after losing more than $1 billion of his clients' money to Bernard Madoff, René Thierry Magon de la Vichue had enough. He locked the door of his Madison Avenue office and apparently swallowed sleeping pills and slashed his wrists with a box cutter, police said. A security guard found his body Tuesday morning next to a garbage can placed to catch the blood. The bloody scene marked a grisly turn in the Madoff scandal, in which money managers and investors were ensnared in an alleged $50 billion Ponzi scheme. De la Vichue is believed to have lost about $1.4 billion to Madoff. No suicide note was found, said New York Police Department spokesman Paul Brown. Ellen Borikov, spokesman for the city medical examiner, said the autopsy on De la Vichue had been completed Wednesday. She said the medical examiner was awaiting toxicology reports before determining the cause of death. Skipping down. De la Vichue, 65, was an esteemed financier who tapped his upper-crust European connections to attract clients. It was not immediately clear how he knew Madoff or who his clients were. Note that. A lot of mystery about this as well as, did he really kill himself, or was it live, as I say, or was it Memorex? Speaking of De La Vichue, and I may be mispronouncing that, A partner in the firm, he grew increasingly subdued after the Madoff scandal broke, drawing suspicion among janitors in his office Monday night when he demanded that they be out of there by 7 p.m. A partner in the firm asked a security guard later in the evening to check and see if De La Vieu Shui was still there, but the door was locked, Police Commissioner Raymond Kelly said. When a guard came into the 22nd-story office suite the next morning, less than 13 hours later, the Frenchman was dead, Brown said. There were several cuts, quote, to his arm, to his wrist, and also to his bicep area, unquote, Kelly said. Note that. To his arm, to his wrist, and to his bicep area. If he was going to kill himself, you think he would have missed and hit himself in the bicep? Got my doubts, folks. Really got my doubts. That's one of the reasons I'm suspicious here. Plus, this... Again, it's tempting to violate FCC regs. Ain't going to do it for those of you who are on the stations that carry the program, but yeah, right. He was cutting his own wrist with a box cutter and just slipped and hit himself in the bicep. He did. Apparently, there were some empty sleeping pills. Maybe those were kicking in, but I've got my doubts, unless he was awfully wasted on those sleeping pills. Sounds like maybe somebody was doing the job for him. Continuing, his death came as swindle investors began looking for ways to recoup their losses. Funds that lost big to Madoff were also facing investor lawsuits and backlash for failing to properly vet Madoff and overlooking red flags that could have steered them away. It's not immediately known what kind of scrutiny De La Vieu Shui was facing over his losses. De La, and now it's pronounced Vieu Shui, comes from rich French lineage with the Magon part of his name referring to one of France's most powerful families. The Magon name is even listed on L'Arc de Triomphe in Paris, a monument commissioned by Napoleon in 1806. He's irreproachable, said Bill Rapavy, who was Access International's chief operating officer before founding his own firm in 2007. De Vieu Shui's firm enlisted intermediaries with links to wealthy Europeans to garner investors. Among them was Philippe Jeannot, a French businessman and friend who was the former husband of Princess Caroline of Monaco, and Prince Michael, or Prince Michel, of Yugoslavia. De La Vieu Shui, the former chairman and chief executive of Crédit Lyonnais Securities USA, was also known as a keen sailor who regularly participated in regattas and was a member of the New York Yacht Club. By the way, Crédit Lyonnais was dirty as hell, too. I would also note that Philippe Jeannot was married into the royal family of Monaco. There was a branch of the P2 Lodge to which the late Princess Grace was reportedly connected. And when Princess Grace died, the former Grace Kelly, when Princess Grace died in a car accident, turned out she also had been hooked up with, among others, Licio Gelli, the Grand Master of the P2 Lodge. So again, note that this guy was investing on behalf of the European elite. Note that he was part of the French aristocracy and financial elite. They are a major element of the Bormann Capital Network, as were the Thyssen. So where did the money go? They say investors may have taken some of it. And again, who knows? The guy supposedly took a whole bunch of sleeping pills. I've never attempted suicide, let alone killed myself, so I can't say if the sleeping pills are kicking in, whether you miss your wrists enough to hit yourself in the bicep. Sounds to me like maybe he was getting done, though, and maybe he was actually struggling, but who knows? That's a heck of a miss. And also, I think there's reason to suspect that foul play is something that could very well befall others connected to Lee Harvey Madoff, the alleged lone nut of this whole operation. Following is an AP story by Jay Lindsay from December 19th of 2008, Dateline Boston, headlined, Massachusetts investors saw inside Madoff scam. It reads in part, his repeated warnings that Wall Street money manager Bernard Madoff was running a giant Ponzi scheme have cast Harry Markopoulos as an unheeded prophet. But people who know or work with Markopoulos say it wasn't prescience that helped him foresee the collapse of Madoff's alleged $50 billion fraud. Instead, they say diligence and a strong moral sense drove his quixotic 9-year quest to alert regulators about Madoff. And by the way, he'd been alerting the SEC for some time. Skipping down. In 2005, he submitted a report to the Securities and Exchange Commission saying it was, quote, highly likely, unquote, that, again quoting, Madoff Securities is the world's largest Ponzi scheme, unquote. In the report, he says he knew his research could ruin people's careers and asked the SEC to be discreet about circulating the report and his name. In this report to the SEC, by the way, look what he wrote, quote, I am worried about the personal safety of myself and my family, unquote, he wrote. That in his 2005 report to the SEC. Well, who was he afraid of? I don't think he was afraid of Lee Harvey Madoff. Who knows? Maybe Mr. Viu Shui could have profited from the insights of Mr. Markopoulos. Again, I think there's a whole lot more here than just a lone nut. One of my favorite words, obviously, something that I use a lot, is milieu. And in investigating the operations of Lee Harvey Madoff, and again, the sarcasm couldn't be exaggerated. This is no lone nut, folks. Any more than Lee Harvey Oswald was. The milieu, or as a trusted friend and associate put it, the community of interests, or Interessengemeinschaft, that of which the Madoff operation was part, is well worth noting. There is a New York Times article that talks about some of the milieu, my favorite word again. This from the New York Times of December 17th of 2008, an article by Eric Konigsberg, in fraud case, middlemen in spotlight. As a go-between who shepherded clients and their money to Bernard L. Madoff, Walter M. Noel became so prosperous that he was only too happy to show off his good fortune to the world. In 2002, Vanity Fair dispatched the photographer Bruce Weber to shoot a lavish spread of Mr. Noel's wife and their five grown daughters at his home in Connecticut. That was followed in 2005 by a town and country story on the Noel family's tropical retreat in Moustique. Skipping down, of Mr. Noel, again, one of the middlemen in this operation. Speaking of the family, they built a modestly prosperous life in Greenwich and were perhaps best known among associates for their Christmas cards, the people with five stunning girls, in the words of a family friend. Quote, as we know, Walter's success came after several thin years, wrote John J. McCloy II, a banker from Greenwich who described himself and his wife Laura as the Knowles' best friends for more than 30 years, unquote, in May, in a letter recommending to the Knowles to membership in a private club. Well, John J. McCloy II is the son of John J. McCloy I, who was not only chairman of the Chase Manhattan Bank, not only one of the people who set up the M Fund and the Black Eagle Trust, as reported in the consummately important book Gold Warriors by Peggy and Sterling Seagrave. He also was a key Warren Commission member. He also was U.S. High Commissioner for Germany and helped to release many of the top Nazi war criminals into the service of the Galen Organization and ultimately into the service of the Republican Party, courtesy of the Crusade for Freedom. John J. McCloy, interestingly enough, to give you an idea how tight these milieu, plural, are, John J. McCloy was a brother-in-law of Konrad Adenauer of Germany, the first Chancellor of Germany, and a front in many ways for the Underground Reich. And C. Lewis Douglas, the chairman of the Finance Commission for the U.S. military government that was administering Germany after the war, they were all brothers-in-law. They were all married to daughters of a key Morgan partner named Frederick Zinser. John J. McCloy II, like John J. McCloy I, a member of the American Council for Germany, one of the things that helps to coordinate, helped to coordinate German and American policy, and something that is inextricably linked with the various Bormann networks. So Walter Noel's best friend for 30 years, one of the key Madoff people, John J. McCloy II, the son of John J. McCloy I, who, among other things, helped to tab Lee Harvey Oswald as the lone nut behind President Kennedy's assassination. Of course, he was not a lone nut. So another name that crops up here in connection with Lee Harvey Madoff is former SEC and Exchange Commission boss Arthur Levitt. The Washington Post's, or the Chicago Tribune's Swamp Politics, that's their Washington, D.C., operation, has an article, The Swamp, Madoff SEC's Very Cozy Tie by Frank James. Ex-Securities and Exchange Commission boss Arthur Levitt yesterday fired back at critics trying to lay at his feet some of the blame for the Bernie Madoff scandal, saying he wasn't asleep at the switch. At this point, I don't see any evidence that the SEC dropped the ball, unquote. Levitt, who's now an advisor to private equity shop Carlyle Group, told the New York Post. He's shocked. He doesn't see any gambling going on. Former SEC head, now he works for the Carlyle Group, which, among other things, is where the Bush and Bin Laden family fortunes, quite literally, meet. Who audited the Madoff firm? Check this out from Bloomberg.com. Investment advisor Axia warned clients of Madoff's red flags. Skipping down, Bernard L. Madoff Investment Securities LLC used Freeling and Horowitz, an auditor operating out of a 13 by 18 foot location in an office park in New York City's northern suburbs. Madoff was charged by federal prosecutors on December 11th with running what he said was a $50 billion Ponzi scheme. The auditor signed off on Madoff's annual financial statement through October 31st of 2006, according to a copy obtained by Bloomberg News. Now, check this out. New York-based Axia urged clients last year not to invest with Madoff's firm after learning the identity of the New City, New York-based auditor, according to Jake Waltower, head of advisory services at Axia. Freeling and Horowitz included one partner in his late 70s who lives in Florida, a secretary, and one active accountant. Skipping down, another woman in a nearby office, Leslie Kusar, said the man who comes to the auditor's office does so for 10 to 15 minute periods and wears tight pants and tie-dyed shirts. Kusar, she said, she never saw anyone else go into the office during the day, but at about 5:30 p.m. another man would show up and use the location. He's in and out of there, unquote, Kusar said. So that's who's doing this. One of the sidelights, and I'm going to have to attenuate this, this is an example of why listeners should be using the website, because just not going to have time to go into this past a point. But one of the big losers in the Madoff scandal are not only individual Jewish investors, many of whom invest in Israel, but also many Jewish charities and also charitable efforts that help to support Israeli infrastructure. This, as another Mideast war of whatever size and duration remains to be seen, is breaking out. The Jewish Journal talks about how many, and again, this is an article from December 12th, how many Jewish investors got burned. This will be excerpted and discussed at greater length in the description for the show. San Francisco Chronicle of Wednesday, December 17th of 2008, has an article, Jewish Charities Lose Big with Madoff Investments. Skipping down, experts estimate that about 5% of all money donated by American Jews and 20% donated to Jewish causes goes to Israel. And Eli Wiesel's foundation lost nearly everything. Eli Wiesel, a Holocaust survivor, his foundation was almost completely bankrupted. Anti-Semitic web postings are up in the wake of the Madoff scandal. I would also note that a consortium of European banks that bought out ABN AMRO and apparently lost a lot in the subprime crisis are now going to be able to scapegoat Lee Harvey Madoff. The Borman Group, as discussed in the book Martin Borman, Nazi in Exile, and in For the Record 305, uses Jews. Please go to the 305 end of the Borman book in order to access that information. Why would a Nazi network use Jews? Well, several reasons. First of all, what a great cover for a Nazi money-moving operation than Jews. Second of all, since that operation, the Borman Group, is the largest aggregate of money power under a single control in history, as tabbed by one knowledgeable banker, you can blame control of the economy on, ta-da, the Jews. And then when it goes down, you can scapegoat the Jews. Also, before the Nazis liquidated the Jews, they expropriated all of their property. What a great way of expropriating Jewish property, perhaps prior to exterminating them, than to have a Borman Jew set up the vehicle for looting that property. We're going to conclude with an article from the worldtribune.com. Doomsday. U.S. report warns of strategic shock leading to massive unrest. It's from December 15th. The report by the U.S. Army War College's Strategic Institute said that a defense community paralyzed by conventional thinking could be unprepared to help the United States. Skipping down, deliberate employment of weapons of mass destruction or other catastrophic capabilities, unforeseen economic collapse, and those are among the disasters for which our military may not be prepared. Well, we'll see what happens, folks. This, however, wraps up For the Record program number 658, Side 2. Update on the meltdown. My name is Dave Emery. This has been recorded on December 28th of 2008. Happy New Year.